Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Linda Siegel. She is the legislative correspondent for the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. She's on the board of the Santa Fe Community College. She is a lobbyist, and she gives us legislative updates during the session, which starts next year on Tuesday, the 18th of January. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, Mary Charlotte. Glad to be here again.
So we've been doing this for so long that we have seen the agony and the ecstasy. We have seen budget surpluses. We've seen lean years. Now we're looking to a really lean year. Namely, we've got a very big budget shortfall. How big is this budget shortfall?
Well, that's a really good question because there's some disagreement depending on who you ask. And if you ask the Legislative Finance Committee, the budget shortfall is about $257 million. And if you ask the Department of Finance Administration, it's about $450 million. But the reality is there are some assumptions that the LFC takes in making their lower estimate. And they're taking the assumption that we will continue to have to suspend the ERB contribution, and the ERB is the Educational Retirement Board, and that is where all the teachers and colleges and universities pay in for their retirement fund. Well, last year we suspended a portion of the state's contribution, and they're assuming that we're going to do that again to the tune of about $90 million. And then there's the assumption that in education, in public education, we will not replace about $88 million of stimulus money. And that really accounts for most of the difference between those two estimates. And if suddenly that changes, then we go back to the $450 million.
So worst case, $450 million?
Best case, $250-ish.
Okay. So what is the total budget of New Mexico as it stands?
Well, it's very interesting because you were talking about flush times and lean times, and we really were in the flush times just a few years ago, where we had one year almost $1 billion of capital outlay. We talked a lot about that on your show.
And they didn't save it for years
like
this? Of course
they didn't save it. We spent every penny of it on mostly good things. Building more senior centers, building more water infrastructure, building more buildings of all different types. So it was a good time, but now we're really in dire straits, and this is the worst it's probably ever been, with our budget declining from a high of $6.2 billion in 2007 to a budget today in this fiscal year, and the fiscal year, of course, runs from July 1 to June 30th. In this fiscal year, we have a budget about $5.4 billion, but a couple hundred million of that is stimulus money, which is bye-bye. It
right.
is gone for the next fiscal year. So in essence, if we didn't have that stimulus money, we would have lost about $1 billion from our high budget of 6.2 to a budget without stimulus of 5.2. So it's a dramatic difference in the services the state can provide, the number of employees that we have in state government.
If my little calculations that I'm doing here in real time on my computer calculator are correct, then it's approximately 7.2% difference between the budget of $6.2 billion and the shortfall is 7.2% of that.
That sounds low, but could you have the calculator?
Okay, wait a minute. So if you use the lower budget figure than our all-time high, it's a 9%. Our budget shortfall is 9% of total budget.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, and
a
20% decline over 3 years, which
right.
is huge.
So when you think about that, there's so many different ways to think about it, and that's where it gets confusing, and that's where we try to bring some clarity for our listeners. Okay, we've had an all-time high 3 years ago, but that was a great and rapid buildup because we had high oil and gas revenues.
Yeah, a lot of things were looking good for us. Gross receipts were up. Gross receipts taxes were up. Corporate income tax was up. Personal income tax was up some, even though we gave people huge cuts starting in 2003 and going through 2005 or 6. So many factors contributed to our highs. And actually, right now, gas is very high. Gas is still above $80 a barrel. We have had some decline in the number of wells, but I think those are coming back. The biggest problem right now for us in the revenue of gas and oil is natural gas. That's where we make a ton of money. A 10% increase in the cubic, however they measure it, cubic foot, whatever, gives us $12 million of revenue. So when natural gas goes down to its low now of around less than $3.50, I think, right now, and at its high at $6 or $7, I mean, we were rolling in the money, and that decline has really hurt us. And natural gas seems to be plentiful throughout the country right now.
It's so strange because my natural gas heating bills haven't gone down.
Isn't that interesting? I can't tell you why, but it's certainly not because of the price.
We're talking to Linda Siegel about the upcoming session, legislative session, and the budget crisis, which will be the big news probably for 2 solid months or more if you count the fact that we're starting now in December. So what are the biggest pieces of the pie in the state budget? What does it actually look like?
Well, public education is about 46% of the total budget. So if you look at a $5.2 billion budget, education is over $2 billion. And then when you've got 47% public education, then you've got Medicaid, which is our program of health care to low-income people, to kids who don't have other resources. And that's about 12 to 13%. When you add those two together, you're looking at approximately 60% of the budget in public education and Medicaid.
Now, how much of the Medicaid comes from the federal government?
Well, that's just the state dollars.
Okay.
A huge amount comes from the feds. We have about a 3 to 4 to 1 match, depending on what kind of Medicaid it is. So,
meaning the Fed provides $3 or $4 for every dollar we provide?
Right. So if you do it at a dollar, if we're at about 28 cents, the feds provide 72 cents on most types of Medicaid. They're all different kinds of Medicaid. Some are better matches than others.
So if we cut Medicaid, then for every dollar we cut Medicaid, we're cutting $3 or $4 that come from our income taxes to the IRS.
Absolutely.
So that's what we might call very, very bad.
That's what we like to say. Very, very bad. And so there's 60% of your budget. And as you may remember in the campaign rhetoric for the governor's race, both candidates, Diane Dinesh and Susana Martinez, said, we're not going to touch public education and we're not going to touch Medicaid. Well, if you don't touch public education and Medicaid, then that leaves 40% of the budget where you're going to have to make those huge cuts. Either you're either going to have to cut the $250 million or the $450 million, depending what it is, out of 40% of the state budget.
Which then you're looking at your state parks, and you're looking at cultural affairs, and you're looking
environmental
at the protection.
Department of Health, the Children, Youth, and Families Department, transportation, what little we do in state dollars there, and corrections, and public safety. Senator John Arthur Smith at a hearing last week said, if the amount we have to cut from the budget is around $350 million, If we cut across the board, meaning every department, including public education and Medicaid, we would have to do a 7% cut. If we hold harmless public education and Medicaid, that means a 22% cut to all those other departments,
which will be
devastating to health and social services, to mental health services, to developmentally disabled services, to domestic violence, to child care.
Now, let's just do some more math here. $350 million, you have to make that up. We've got 2 million people in the state of New Mexico. Everybody pays $170 extra dollars a year, and you're done.
If only it were that easy.
That's not that much money if you do a progressive tax. People at the top do a little more. People at the bottom do a little less.
Well, as you know, we have a pretty much a flat tax rate of around 4.8%. There, it goes down a little bit, I think maybe to 4.2 or 3. But we really flattened out the tax rate in 2003 with the legislation that was passed to decrease. We had a fairly high income tax rate of 8%, and now it's not.
So, again, I've just taken out my trusty little computer calculator. That's $14 a month per person.
Mm-hmm.
To save us from the most drastic cuts that the state has ever seen. I don't get, what's the problem?
Politics. And unfortunately, the economic situation in the state. In 2008, we had 3.7% of people unemployed. And now, today, well, February's figures had us at 8.7%, and I think we're about to 8.9% of New Mexicans don't have jobs.
Right.
And that's hard. That's very hard for a lot of those people.
Right, right. So what does the discussion look like so far? I mean, you are involved in these questions of the state budget from multiple points of view. Are they talking about cutting public education after all? Are they talking about doing 22% cuts and everything else? Are they talking about touching Medicaid? What's on the minds of the people who make those big decisions?
Well, I think we've seen lately the governor-elect Martinez has realized that we can't cut 22% of the 40% of the budget because, you know, we'd have to let people out of jail and our social services and health services would decline dramatically.
Let people out of jail. Let drug offenders, let marijuana smokers out of jail.
Absolutely. Well, that's another program that might be cut, but we should talk about that in another time.
Okay.
Anyway, so there's a realization that probably those campaign promises are not going to be able to be kept because of the size of the deficit. And that means there's a lot more discussion happening about what are we going to do. And the Legislative Finance Committee has always been talking about we really probably can't do it that way of holding harmless two of the main departments. So I think that we're going to see the budgets come out probably that first week of, towards the end of that first week of January, where the new administration, the Martinez administration, will have their budget version, and the Legislative Finance Committee will have its budget version. And I think we're going to see some across-the-board cuts, just because it doesn't seem feasible to do it any other way.
Now, how different from what you've been able to see so far, and we'll talk about this ad infinitum when the legislative session is actually happening, but are there big philosophical differences so far between the Legislative Finance Committee and the future Martinez administration?
I think that probably at this point everybody has faced the reality that we're going to have to do major and huge cuts and that they are going to be painful. Where they are is still up for grabs. Are we going to just cut education by a couple of percent? Are we going to, what are we going to do with Medicaid, which, as you pointed out, is a huge revenue generator? And so I think that remains to be seen, the impact that's going to happen. Now, everyone would love it if by the middle of January the revenues were up again, because the gross receipts tax is actually up about $58 million. So that's a positive sign showing that we are inching towards a better economy. But we're not seeing that in the unemployment numbers. And, of course, the new administration has also said no new taxes. And that makes even the most...
$14 a month.
But, unfortunately, that makes even the most liberal Democrat unable or not feeling like there's much point in trying to pass tax increase bills. And, of course, we did do some tax increases in the last session. They have generated about $180 million. Which,
what were those? What kind of taxes were
those?
Well,
there was an increase to the gross receipts tax of 0.5%. There was a tobacco pack, cigarette pack increase of 75 cents, and there were a couple of other small increases. And then, of course, the legislature passed a small percentage increase to the food tax, and the governor vetoed that. And that would have been another $60 million. I think it was $60 million.
The tax cuts that the Richardson administration passed over the years, I can't remember what year. Years.
2003, and then it was incrementally declined. The income tax incrementally declined till... Six or seven.
If those were brought back to their previous levels, do we know how much of the shortfall would be made up?
Well, if we had the numbers from the high, and if in 2007 we had brought those income taxes back up, it was over $400 million. Now, because of the high unemployment and people's... A lot of people's wages are frozen. I haven't seen an estimate, but we can assume that it's over $200-$250 million, I think, easily.
And so that would be a huge step.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's your deficit.
Yeah.
The LFC version of the deficit would probably be handled by taking our income taxes back to that position.
We're talking to Linda Siegel about the state budget. One of the ways that has been discussed to reduce the size of the budget is restructuring state government. What does that mean? What does that look like? What's being discussed?
Well, Representative Lucky Varela from here in Santa Fe sponsored a bill which passed and was signed to create a restructuring task force. And on that task force were legislators and regular citizens who had some expertise. And that committee has been meeting since May or June. And they just actually came out with their final recommendations on Monday of this week. And they looked at a lot of different things. And I think when they came into it, the idea was, well, if we restructure state government, we're going to save a lot of money. We're going to combine departments, and we're going to, you know, save millions and millions of dollars. And as it went on, it appeared that probably wasn't going to happen. That by combining the public education department and the higher education and department, you probably weren't going to save millions and millions of dollars because you still have to have the infrastructures of those two departments. You
right.
might have one secretary and a few fewer deputy secretaries, but you've still got to have the accounting department and the program departments and all those other categories to monitor and to provide all the services that people in those departments provide. But they've pretty much given up on the idea of combining those two departments, which was initially a big piece of the conversation. And they've come down to combining some of the smaller departments. I mean, one of the things that Richardson did was create a lot of new departments, like the Office of Indian Affairs, the Cultural Affairs Department, there are several more. Economic development, I think, already existed. But what the task force recommended was taking some of these smaller departments and putting them together, like creating a commerce department and putting economic development, tourism, workforce solutions, and the border authority into that one department. That's, you know, that will save a little money. You don't have all those secretaries. Looking at Homeland Security and combining it with the Public Safety Department and the Emergency Management Department, which is the 911 or the Emergency Management Section. In that department, they're also looking at placing the Fire Marshal, which is currently in the Public Regulation Commission. The task force spent some time talking about eliminating the Public Regulation Commission. Of course, that is the entity that has five elected public regulation commissioners, where we've seen a lot of scandal in that department over the last few years, and a lot of discussion around the insurance department, which is also in the Public Regulation Commission, and should we pull out the insurance division and put it in the Department of Health. And we still may see some pieces of legislation around that. Another bill looking at merging the Health Policy Commission, parts of Medicaid, behavioral health, all the entities that are self-insured for insurance, like APS, the Albuquerque Public Schools, and the retiree health care, putting them all together.
So does that mean let's say you merge two or three departments along the lines mm-hmm. you're talking about, do they all then go into one building? Do they like move their offices and that kind of thing? What happens?
Not necessarily. It could just mean that a lot of services are consolidated and that there's more coordination. One of the things they were looking for was more communication and coordination. I know with public education and higher ed, that was a big complaint of legislators. You people don't talk to each other in these departments. And to some extent, that is true. And so merging departments can help do better coordination, particularly like if you're looking at the Commerce Department, putting Economic Development and Workforce Solutions, which is like the old Department of Labor, putting those together, that might be a good idea. So they were looking for, towards the end, efficiencies rather than saving tons of money.
So that seems like something actually good and useful and efficient could come out of it, but what does it mean for the budget shortfall?
Right, it doesn't mean very much for the budget shortfall, but it does mean it's a lot of, okay, we're trying to do something. We've expanded government, because remember when Gary Johnson was governor, when he left, the budget was $4.8 billion.
Right.
And at our high, as we just talked about, it was 6.2. So there was a lot of expansion of government in 4 or 5 years.
Right.
And the idea now is to take it back down. And we could easily be, if we don't come out of this current situation and our revenues don't start to increase, we could easily be back at those 2003 levels in another year or two.
And it's tricky because those things were added because there were tremendous necessities in the state and people's needs not being met, and now they're met, and then you take them away. It's at least as bad or in some ways worse than before.
Well, it is worse because in actuality, there are many more poor people. There are many more kids who need health care. There are many more developmentally disabled who are not getting services. We're looking at making huge cuts to child care services for low-income working adults. How are they going to keep working if they don't have a place to put their kids? All of those things are increasing, and yet our revenues are decreasing. And we really never even met the need when we were at those high levels. We were doing better, obviously. And was there some waste? I'm sure there was waste. But
Right. There
wasn't $1 billion worth of waste. And now we are seeing a lot of services going away and a lot of people needing those services.
And as we discussed just yesterday on this program with youth shelters and St. Elizabeth's shelter, it's precisely in times of economic necessity when those services are most needed that they tend to go away.
Right.
I just did a recalculation here. yes, ladies and gentlemen, I do carry a calculator wherever I go. It's true. If you account for, let's say, 10% unemployment and you have the 90% of employed people paying into the system, $20.83 a month make up our budget shortfall.
Well, remember,
just saying, that's less than a dollar a day.
Yes. Remember, too, though, Mary Charlotte, we do have people on fixed incomes like SSI and Social Security disability. But it does show that it wouldn't take that much to get us out
exactly of
the situation we're in. One of the other areas of cuts, this restructuring task force spent a lot of time looking at our boards and commissions. And we had, I think it was over 200 boards and commissions. And they have a 61-page bill that they just released on Monday where they are eliminating many, many boards and commissions. And a lot of them were voluntary boards and commissions, and like the Beef Council and the Domestic Violence Leadership Council and the Youth Alliance Council and the State Library Commission.
Well, if they're volunteer, then what good does it do to eliminate them?
Well, some of them paid per diem. Some of them had staffing, regular staff having to staff them. So will they save a lot of money? Again, probably not, but they streamline government, and some of the ideas to combine certain commissions that can be combined.
Right, so you combine the podiatry board with the livestock board.
Well, actually, in the last legislative session, there was a bill to combine all the licensed healthcare boards under the medical board. And, of course, everyone, as they should, went ballistic, because you can't put nurses and podiatrists and chiropractors and OTs and PTs under the physician board. That just doesn't work. The purpose of licensing boards is to regulate that profession.
Right.
And to, you know, deal with their disciplinary issues. And the other thing is, all those licensing boards are self-sufficient, so they're not costing the taxpayers a dime. It's the people who are licensed that pay for it.
Right.
And that bill went down in flames. But they did bring it up at the beginning of the restructuring task force, and people were able to convince them that that wasn't a place to save money and it wasn't going to do anything except make it harder for consumers to be protected by these boards, because that's the purpose of them.
So, 1 point for rationality.
Yeah, that was a good one.
We're talking to Linda Siegel about the legislative session upcoming and the budget situation in the state of New Mexico. So, let's talk about education, that sacrosanct area in which no cuts may ever be made. What kind of cuts are they talking about making?
Well, the Legislative Education Study Committee is the group of legislators that meets year-round when the legislature's not in session, looking at all these public education issues and, to some extent, higher ed. And they have been struggling with trying to find some areas where cuts could be made to at least make up that $88 million that we talked about earlier, which is stimulus money. And they've come up with some ideas, reducing the number of school days. It costs $12.8 million a day for all the public schools to have their day of school. They're looking at maybe cutting one or two days of that. There are professional days for teachers.
Well, do teachers not get paid if there's like a snow day or if there's one less day of school?
Well, there's a whole lot of other expenses that go with a school day, you know, keeping the school open, having the janitors, having the administrative staff. I don't know exactly how they figure out that $12 million, but they say that by reducing the school days, they can save that much a day.
Do you think children will protest?
Yes, I'm sure they'll be outside with picket signs saying, "We want to be in school." Then another area of proposed cutting is the professional days for teachers, because as everybody in any profession, you need your continuing education, and you need to update your skills, and you need to learn the new things that are going on in your profession. Well, if you would cut professional days, that's worth $11 million a day. So there may be some cuts to that. One of the things that they really want to do is no new schools, no new charter schools, no new public schools being built. Because, of course, that you get a certain amount of money just for the operations of your school. So if they can keep the number of schools down, that potentially could save money. So there would be a moratorium on any new schools, unless, you know, it's an emergency. Like if we hadn't built our new school on the south side in Santa Fe and needed to do that because that's where the population is growing and that's where all the kids are, I suppose we could get an exception to that. But I think that's a bill that will pass. And then another area that they want to look at is, in, you might remember in 2003, we passed a constitutional amendment in a special election in September to take a higher percentage out of the land grant permanent fund. The land grant permanent fund is about a $9 billion fund that pays for a lot of public schools, that contributes hundreds of millions of dollars every year.
How's it invested?
That's been a big issue with both of our permanent funds, the severance tax and the land grant permanent fund, and of course some of the scandals around that. And
I hope they didn't give it to Madoff.
We did have a very small amount of Madoff.
Is that right?
Yes, we did, but it wasn't too much. Anyway, it's invested in all kinds of things, but it's been after the fall a few years ago, it's been growing back, and it's doing pretty well right now. But we agreed to take out a higher percentage of money to help fund the teacher increases in salaries that we did and in trying to improve education. Well, that money starts to decline and go back down in 2013, I think it is. So we would have to do another constitutional amendment to keep that money at its current level, which is about 5.5%. So I think they're looking at doing that. Allowing schools to keep their cash balances so that they can use them for emergency funds. Right now, you can't have any cash balances.
What does that mean? I don't understand.
Well, like if you're, you know, everybody... Like at the community college, we need to have so much money in the bank. So if state government cuts us off for some reason, we've got enough to make payroll for a couple of months till we decline. And in the public schools, they haven't been able to maintain their cash balances, and this would allow them to keep those and be able to use them in future years. And I mean, nobody's rolling in the dough in public education. And the ERB contribution, which we talked about, keeping that suspended.
That's a retirement.
That's the retirement account for educators, keeping the percentage amount that's suspended that saves the state $90 million.
What does that mean, suspended?
It means
who's
that
suspending what?
The state pays in a certain percentage on every single education employee. They match a certain amount. The employee pays something, and the state pays something. And
into what will later be your pension.
The retirement fund, yes, the education retirement fund. And then we have it for state employees, where the state pays in a certain percentage, the employee pays in a certain percentage. And the employees are now, one of the ideas is to have them pay another 0.5% into the fund, because there's some solvency questions in the future about the education fund.
And is the state still paying its share?
Oh, yeah, it still is, but they've suspended a piece of it.
We're talking to Linda Siegel. One of the things that I learned in an interview that we actually did not too long ago with Amigos Bravos was that there is the opportunity for a little bit of nefariousness in some of these department consolidations, which is if you, for example, merge the Environment Department with the Energy Resources and
Minerals.
And Minerals Department. I think I got the order wrong. But anyway, Energy, Minerals, Natural Resources. Then you have a real chance of doing harm to public health and the environment and environmental protection in the name of saving we know not how much or how little money.
Well, we also know that the current administration wants to do away with or dramatically change the membership on the Environmental Improvement Board, because that's the board that's been doing all the environmental regulations. And the, we've heard a lot about the pit rules for the oil rigs and how onerous the rules that we have in place are to the industry. And we're going to see rollbacks in a lot of those environmental areas.
Or, if I may say, attempted rollbacks.
Yeah, I think we're going to see rollbacks,
but we'll see. I must say, the idea of putting a piece of tarp between toxic waste and your groundwater doesn't seem like the worst possible idea. And they want to get rid of that so they can put the toxic waste directly back into the groundwater.
I think we will see, because a lot of those changes were in regulation and not law, that it will be much easier to eliminate some of those, what you and I would consider important environmental regulations, that those will be gone or changed dramatically.
So as we look forward to the legislative session, what do we see? I mean, we have a slight change in the composition of the legislature.
Yeah, actually, it's kind of significant change, because 8 Democrats lost their seats to Republicans, and that makes the span between Republicans and Democrats only, I think it's 3 in the House of Representatives, where there's been a huge distance between the number of Republicans and the number of Democrats. And that we see that in the Speaker's race. At this moment, we do not know who the Speaker of the House is going to be, even though the Democratic House Caucus has chosen Speaker Lujan to remain as Speaker. There's still that possibility of a challenge by Joe Cervantes from Las Cruces, who, with 3 other House Democrat votes, could make him the Speaker if all the Republicans would vote for him. That the composition of the committees will also change in the House because of the larger number of Republicans, making some of the committees possibly equal Democrats to Republicans, which, if people vote along party lines, which they do sometimes and sometimes not, then there's going to be some ties, perhaps. And
sometimes not. I mean, when was the last time a Republican ever voted with Democrats?
Well, there are bipartisan issues. I mean, when you have, like, professional licensing issue, things that I work on, like nurses, those aren't partisan issues. Child care provided to working people, that's not necessarily a partisan issue.
Okay, so you have a great majority voting for those things.
Yeah.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to go back to one more thing before we wrap up, and that is this question of, okay, you've got declining revenues, you've got a budget which is bigger than the revenues coming in. Where are the revenues coming from? In sort of give us the broad picture.
Well, the largest percentage of our revenues in New Mexico come from gross receipts tax. Those are taxes that we all pay on goods and services. We're one of the few states that taxes services. And
then so you go to your podiatrist,
mm-hmm.
or your doctor. You go to your car mechanic. You
right.
go to Walmart. You go to Collected Works Bookstore. And
yeah.
on all that, you pay gross receipts tax, which is a flat tax.
Well, which actually varies by community, but the state portion of the gross receipts taxes after this increase, actually I think it's 5.25 that the state gets on every single thing you buy
in a store, almost everything. But because
except
then we
food.
Have, well, yes, then we have, and we gave certain exemptions to healthcare providers on certain portions of their income, but not all. And that gross receipts tax generates, it's over 50%, I think, or just under 50% of the entire state revenue. And then you've got hundreds of millions coming from gas and oil, gross personal income tax, corporate income tax. Those are the significant generators of money. And I'm, you know, on one of our other show, our next shows, I'll bring some percentages of exactly how much it is. But gross receipts tax are so, taxes are so important to us.
Now, when the gubernatorial campaign was happening, Diane Dennisch, Democratic candidate who lost, was talking about closing corporate loopholes. Out-of-state corporations would have to pay corporate taxes the way New Mexico corporations do. Susana Martinez was against that. But if that loophole were closed, would that make a big difference?
Well, we've had such varying estimates of how much that money that would generate. Some of the estimates from the Tax and Revenue Department have been as little as $10 million, and some of the biggest were up to $80 million. I think it would bring in tens of millions of dollars if we did the combined reporting of out-of-state corporations. I mean, out-of-state corporations still pay some corporate income taxes, but all the states around us use the combined reporting, and that generates more revenue, and it would generate more in New Mexico, and make it fair for those of us who have New Mexico corporations.
Although it is not popular, I know, I think it is still important to bring here on the radio the whole question of revenue generation into the forefront, whether it be one kind of taxation or another. I mean, there's been, you know, California came very close to legalizing marijuana. Whatever a personal opinion might be about marijuana, it's a huge potential income generator in the state of California, mm-hmm. potentially in the state of New Mexico, any state. And the larger question is, when you have underground economies, mm-hmm. where money is being made in huge amounts and not a single penny of it is being taxed because it's below the radar, because it's right. not legal, those are potentially, if they're not harmful, and that's, of course, the big question with drugs, whether regulating them would increase or reduce the harm, that's a huge potential income generator, revenue generator for mm-hmm. a state.
Yeah, I'm sure it could be. And I think looking at other taxes, alcohol taxes, which we've tried a nickel a drink and a dime a drink, which in reality are not going to stop people from drinking. That,
right.
that it could contribute to the overall income of the state. In fact, I think the last number I looked at for the total amount of revenue generated from alcohol taxes was only $25 million. Well, we probably spend more than that in dealing with all the effects of people who overuse alcohol and
right.
end up in jail and killing people. And
well, and it does also bring up questions of, for example, with cigarettes, the amount of revenue, I mean, the amount of income and profits generated by cigarette sales versus the amount of harm to the health of people and how much that costs in healthcare bills. Looking at those in the same mm-hmm. on the same piece of
right,
paper.
Right. And we know, I mean, I work with the American Cancer Society Action Network, and we know that we spend more on health care than we generate in taxes.
From
cigarette taxes. A lot more.
And so with alcohol, same thing.
Probably. I can't say definitively on alcohol.
And with drugs, it's we get zero revenue, and we spend untold millions, if not billions, in the United States mm-hmm. dealing with the effects of drugs, from everything to burglary,
right.
Injury, gang shootings, and everything else.
Does make you wonder.
It does indeed. Linda Siegel, you are a lobbyist, so let's here and now talk about the groups that you represent.
Well, I represent different nursing groups, advanced practice nursing and the Nurses Association and school nurses. I represent chiropractors, occupational therapists, the child care providers in New Mexico, the Planned Parenthood, groups like that, the Domestic Violence Coalition, lots of associations and nonprofit groups who traditionally don't have as big a voice, perhaps, in the legislature as, say, gas and oil or insurance companies or alcohol and tobacco, but groups that definitely need to have a voice, and I kind of enable that.
It seems like there's different kinds of lobbyists. Those are those who are well-financed by for-profit corporations who are trying to advance their own interests, and those who are probably underfunded by groups that are doing public service in the first place, and that's the latter is what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So we do not think of you as representing nefarious special interests, but rather people who are trying to serve the community in one way or another.
That's what I like to think.
Well, that's why we have you on, because I believe that you can, for that reason, provide an objective look at the entire legislative process. Now, when people hear all of this, and during the session when people get interested in issues and they want to become involved, what is the role of citizens' voices, both now and in the upcoming legislative session?
Well, citizens have multiple opportunities to engage in the process. I mean, the first one is in voting, obviously.
That's done.
Yeah, but also in knowing who your legislators are and actually talking to them. I mean, in Santa Fe, we have a small community. You can run into your legislator at the grocery store or the drugstore, or you could call them up and say, I'd like to meet with you and talk about issues. And they're just people like us, and most of them are more than happy to meet with their constituents. Then when the legislative session starts, there's a great way you can keep track of what's happening, and that's on the website. Just Google New Mexico Legislature. You can pull up the website, and you can find out.
And it's very good.
It's an excellent website with the bills. You can put in keywords and look up bills, find out what's being introduced. Then you can track those bills fairly well, see what committees they're going to. You can pull up the committee schedules and actually go to a hearing on bills if you're interested. And a lot of people are part of different constituency groups that have someone like me following legislation. I know the Santa Fe Public Schools, the parents have gotten together and formed a big group called PLANE. PLANE, P-L-A-N-E, and it stands for parents something, I don't remember. But lots of parents are getting engaged and concerned about what's happening to public education. And I know we're going to have a lot of them up at the Capitol for these education hearings. That's the important things people can do to get involved. Make a phone call to your legislator during the session and say, vote for this bill or don't vote for this bill, or here's what I'm concerned about. And you may talk to them, you may talk to a secretary, but you're engaging in the process. For some reason, we just don't participate in our government anymore. And
why do you suppose that is?
I don't think we teach enough civics in school. We don't make it understandable. When I go into classrooms and talk about what really happens at the legislature, people go, well, that's not what the book says about it, and because they don't get the real flavor and how you can really get involved and how, as a citizen, you can be part of the process.
And you love it.
Oh, yeah, I love doing the advocacy trainings and education about what happens and how you can engage whatever your political affiliation is or your positions on issues.
And in your work as somebody who's been trying to influence the direction of our state, do you feel that you've been able to, you collectively with the other people you work with, to steer legislation in the right direction?
I think that there have been lots of positive changes in New Mexico.
What have been some of your greatest successes?
Well, I think during the times of money, we were able to expand a lot of essential services, looking at domestic violence, looking at child care, looking at services for the aging, for disabled adults. I've worked on all those issues, and at least at many times we were able to change laws that positively impacted people, and also get some more funding for services on the, as most of your listeners probably know, I've worked a lot on gay rights issues, and we have a non-discrimination law in New Mexico in employment, and we have a hate crimes bill that contains all the list of people who shouldn't be, well, no one should be the victim of a crime, but for hate crimes that are bias-based, we've included all the list of categories. And just a lot of health and social service things have really been impacted by people like me who work for different groups and agencies to have that voice be there. So it's not that you just hear from the industry.
Right. Linda Siegel is the legislative correspondent for the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. The legislative session starts on Tuesday, the 18th of January in the new year. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. And by the way, I'm doing a little survey at facebook.com/radiocafe, so check it out. Give your opinions about the Santa Fe Radio Cafe at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz. Thank you.